Chapter 1. The Dance. The dance of subatomic particles never ends, and it is never the same. However, physicists have found a way to diagram the parts of it that interest them. The simplest drawing of any type of movement is a space map. A space map shows the location of things in space. A map, for example, might show the positions of San Francisco, California, and Berkeley, California. The vertical axis is the north-south axis, as on any map, and the horizontal axis is the east-west line. The map might also show the path of a helicopter flying between San Francisco and Berkeley, and on a greatly enlarged basis, it might show the path of a proton traveling around the cyclotron at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. Like all road maps, this space map is two-dimensional. It shows how far north, the first dimension, and how far east, the second dimension, Berkeley is of San Francisco. It does not show the altitude of the helicopter, the third dimension, and it does not indicate how much time, the fourth dimension, the flight from San Francisco to Berkeley required. If we want to show the time involved in the San Francisco-Berkeley flight, we must draw a space-time map. A space-time map shows the positions of things in space, and it also shows their positions in time. The vertical axis on a space-time map is the time axis. Space-time maps are read from the bottom up because the passage of time is represented by movement up the time axis. The horizontal axis of a space-time map is the space axis, which shows the movement of objects in space. The path traced by an object on a space-time map is called its world line. For example, a space-time map might show the same flight from San Francisco to Berkeley. Initially, the helicopter is sitting on the ground in San Francisco. When the helicopter takes off for Berkeley, it moves forward both in time and space, and its world line traces the diagonal path on the space-time map between B and C. When it lands in Berkeley, its world line is vertical once again because it no longer moves in space, but like all things, it continues to move in time, point C to point D. It can move backward and forward in space, but of course it can only move forward in time. The world lines of San Francisco and Berkeley are vertical lines, which do not move in space at all, except during California earthquakes. Physicists use similar space-time maps to diagram particle interactions. Imagine a space-time diagram of an electron emitting a photon. Starting at the lower left-hand corner of our space-time map, an electron moves through space with a certain velocity, indicated by a diagonal line moving from lower left to upper right. At a point in space and time indicated, say, by a dot, it emits a photon. The photon flies off at the speed of light, upwards and to the right, and the electron, its momentum affected by the emission of the photon, alters course and moves off more slowly at a less extreme angle, upwards and to the left. In 1949, Richard Feynman discovered that space-time maps like these have an exact correspondence with mathematical expressions, which give the probabilities of the interactions that they depict. Feynman's discovery was an extension of Dirac's 1928 theory, and it helped to evolve that theory into the quantum field theory that we know today. Therefore, this type of diagram is sometimes called a Feynman diagram. Here is a Feynman diagram of a particle-antiparticle annihilation. An electron on the left approaches an anti-electron, a positron, which is coming from the right. Their movements indicated by two diagonal lines, one starting from the lower left and one starting from the lower right. The two lines meet at the center of the space-time diagram. At their point of contact, indicated by the dot, they mutually annihilate each other, and two photons are created which depart in opposite directions at the speed of light. Their movement, in space and time, indicated by two dotted lines moving out at flattened angles in opposite directions. A happening in the subatomic world is called an event. Events are indicated in Feynman diagrams by dots. Every subatomic event is marked by the annihilation of the initial particles and the creation of new ones. This is true for every event, and not only those involving particles and antiparticles. With this in mind, let's go back to our previous example of an electron emitting a photon. Instead of saying that an electron moving through space emitted a photon which changed its, the electron's, momentum, we can say as well that an electron moving through space emitted a photon and went out of existence at that point. A new electron was created in this process and it departed the scene with a new momentum. There is no way of knowing if this interpretation is correct or not because all electrons are identical. However, it is simpler and more consistent to assume that the original particle was annihilated and a new particle was created. The indistinguishability of subatomic particles makes this possible. Now we have a Feynman diagram of a process we discussed in the previous chapter. A negative pi meson collides with a proton and the two particles are annihilated. Their energy of being, mass, and energy of motion create two new particles, a lambda particle and a neutral K meson. These two new particles are unstable and live less than a billionth of a second before they decay into other particles. The neutral K meson decays into a positive pi meson and a negative pi meson. The lambda particle, and this is the interesting part, decays into the original two particles, a negative pi meson and a proton. It is as if we smash two toy automobiles together and instead of shattering into bits and pieces, they come apart into more toy automobiles, some of which are as large as the originals. Of course, on our space-time map, all of this is indicated by a series of diagonal intersecting lines, each intersection indicated by a dot or event. Subatomic particles forever partake of this unceasing dance of annihilation and creation. In fact, subatomic particles are this unceasing dance of annihilation and creation. This 20th century discovery, with all its psychedelic implications, is not a new concept. In fact, it is very similar to the way that much of the Earth's population, including the Hindus and the Buddhists, view their reality. Hindu mythology is virtually a large-scale projection into the psychological realm of microscopic scientific discoveries. Hindu deities such as Shiva and Vishnu continually dance the creation and destruction of universes, while the Buddhist image of the wheel of life symbolizes the unending process of birth, death, and rebirth, which is a part of the world of form, which is emptiness, which is form. Imagine that a group of young artists have found a new and revolutionary school of art. Their paintings are so unique that they have come to share them with the curator of an old museum. The curator regards the new paintings, nods his head, and disappears into the vaults of the museum. He returns carrying some very old paintings, which he places beside the new ones. The new art is so similar to the old art that even the young artists are taken aback. The new revolutionaries, in their own time and in their own way, have rediscovered a very old school of painting. Let us look again at the Feynman diagram of an electron-positron annihilation. Each line indicating the motion through space and time of a particle has an arrowhead on it, indicating the direction of motion. Suppose that we use the arrowhead to indicate which is the particle, the electron, and which is the antiparticle, the positron, by making the arrowheads that point up indicate the particles, and arrowheads that point down indicate the antiparticles. That would make a new kind of diagram. Naturally, time as we experience it only travels in one direction, forward, and that is up on a space-time diagram. Nonetheless, this simple convention would give us an easy way of telling particles from antiparticles. World lines that appear to move forward in time would belong to particles, and world lines that appear to move backward in time would belong to antiparticles. Photons would not have arrowheads because they are their own antiparticles. Feynman demonstrated in 1949 that this convention is more than an artistic device. He discovered that a positron field propagating forward in time is mathematically the same as an electron field propagating backward in time. In other words, according to quantum field theory, an antiparticle is a particle moving backward in time. An antiparticle does not have to be considered as a particle moving backward in time, but that is the simplest and most symmetric way of viewing antiparticles. For example, because the arrowheads distinguish the particles from the antiparticles, we can twist the original Feynman diagram around into any position that we choose and still be able to distinguish the one from the other. Each of these variations is a separate diagram and represents a particle-antiparticle interaction. By twisting the original diagram completely around, we can represent every possible interaction between an electron, a positron, and two photons. The precision, simplicity, and symmetry of Feynman diagrams makes them a special type of poetry. Now we come to a space-time diagram of two events. A collision between two photons at point B creates an electron-positron pair, and subsequently an electron and a positron annihilate each other and create two photons at point A. Ordinarily, we would interpret these events as follows. Two photons collide in the lower right of the diagram, producing an electron-positron pair. The electron flies off to the right, while the positron flies off to the left, where it meets another electron which has entered the diagram from the lower left. There they mutually annihilate and create two photons which depart in opposite directions. The preferred interpretation of quantum field theory, however, is much simpler. In it, there is only one particle. That particle, an electron, enters the diagram from the lower left and travels forward in time and space until it emits two photons at point A. This causes it to reverse its direction in time. Traveling backward in time as a positron, it absorbs two photons at point B, reverses its direction in time again, and again becomes an electron. Instead of three particles, there's only one particle, which, moving from left to right, travels first forward in time, then backward in time, and then forward in time again. This is the static type of space-time picture described in Einstein's theory of relativity. If we could survey an entire span of time as we can survey an entire region of space, we would see that events do not unfold with the flow of time, but present themselves complete, like a finished painting on the fabric of space-time. In such a picture, movements backward and forward in time are no more significant than movements backward and forward in space. The illusion of events developing in time is due to our particular type of awareness, which allows us to see only narrow strips of the total space-time picture, one at a time. The illusion of events developing in time is due to our particular type of awareness, which allows us to see only narrow strips of the total space-time picture, one at a time. For example, suppose that we place a piece of cardboard with a narrow strip cut out of it over the diagram we've just discussed, so that all we can see of the interaction is what is visible through the cutout. If we move the cardboard slowly upward, starting at the bottom, our restricted view discovers a series of events, each one happening after the other. First, we see three particles, two photons entering our view from the right and an electron entering from the left. Next, we see the photons collide to produce an electron-positron pair, the electron flying off to the right and the positron flying off to the left. Finally, we see the newly created positron meet the original electron to create two new photons. Only when we remove the entire cardboard, which was an artificial construction anyway, can we see the complete picture. In space-time, wrote de Broglie, everything which for each of us constitutes the past, the present, and the future is given in block. Each observer, as his time passes, discovers, so to speak, new slices of space-time which appear to him as successive aspects of the material world, though in reality the ensemble of events constituting space-time exists prior to his knowledge of them. Wait a minute, says Jim DeWitt to a passing particle physicist. It is easy to talk of movement backward and forward in time, but I never have experienced going backward in time. If particles can travel backward in time, why can't I travel backward in time? The answer which physicists gave to this question is actually quite simple. There is a growing tendency in any closed part of the universe, their explanation goes, for disorder, called entropy, to expand at the price of order, called negentropy. Suppose, for example, that we deposit a drop of black ink into a glass of clear water. Initially, its presence is quite ordered. That is, all of the molecules of ink are located in one small area and are clearly segregated from the molecules of clear water. As time passes, however, natural molecular motion will cause the black ink molecules steadily to intersperse with the clear water molecules until they are distributed evenly throughout the glass, resulting in a murky, homogeneous liquid with no structure or order whatever, only a bland uniformity, maximal entropy. Experience has taught us to associate increasing entropy with the forward movement of time. If we see a movie of a glass of murky water becoming clearer and clearer until all of the foreign substance in it collects into one small drop at the top, we know at once that the film is running backward. Of course, it is theoretically possible for this to happen, but it is so improbable that it simply never, probably, will happen. In short, time flows in the direction of high probability, which is the direction of increasing entropy. The theory of growing disorder, or increasing entropy, is called the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics is statistical. That means it won't work unless there are many entities in a given situation to apply it to. Generally speaking, individual subatomic particles are conceived as such conceptually isolated, short-lived entities that the second law of thermodynamics does not apply to them. It does apply, however, to molecules, which are quite complex compared to subatomic particles, to living cells, which are more complex than molecules, and to people, who are made of billions of cells. It is only at the subatomic or quantum level that the forward flow of time loses its significance. However, there is speculation and some evidence that consciousness, at the most fundamental levels, is a quantum process. The dark-adapted eye, for example, can detect a single photon. If this is so, then it is conceivable that by expanding our awareness to include functions which normally lie beyond its parameters, the way yogis control their body temperature and pulse rate, we can become aware of, experience, these processes themselves. If, at the quantum level, the flow of time has no meaning, and if consciousness is fundamentally a similar process, and if we can become aware of these processes within ourselves, then it is also conceivable that we can experience timelessness. If we can experience the most fundamental functions of our psyche, and if they are quantum in nature, then it is possible that the ordinary conceptions of space and time might not apply to them at all, as they don't seem to apply in dreams. Such an experience would be difficult to describe rationally, infinity in a grain of sand and eternity in an hour. But it would be very real indeed. For this reason, reports of time distortion and timelessness from gurus in the East and LSD trippers in the West ought not, perhaps, to be discarded peremptorily. Subatomic particles do not just sit around being subatomic particles. They are beehives of activity. An electron, for example, constantly is emitting and absorbing photons. These photons are not full-fledged photons, however. They are a now-you-see-it-now-you-don't variety. They are exactly like real photons, except that they don't fly off on their own. They are reabsorbed by the electron almost as soon as they are emitted. Therefore, they are called virtual photons. Virtual means being so in effect or essence, although not in actual fact. They are virtually photons. The only thing that keeps them from being full-fledged photons is their abrupt reabsorption by the electron that emits them. In other words, first there is an electron, then there is an electron and a photon, and then there is an electron again. This situation is, of course, a violation of the conservation law of mass energy. The conservation law of mass energy says, in effect, that we cannot get something for nothing. According to quantum field theory, however, we do get something for nothing, but only for about 1,000 trillionth, 10 to the minus 15th power, of a second. The reason that this can happen, according to the theory, is the famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle, as it originally was formulated, says that the more certain we are of the position of a particle, the less certain we can be about its momentum, and the other way around. We can determine its position precisely, but in that case we cannot determine its momentum at all. If we choose to measure its momentum precisely, then we will not be able to know where it is located. In addition to the reciprocal uncertainty of position and momentum, there also is a reciprocal uncertainty of time and energy. The less uncertainty there is about the time involved in a subatomic event, the more uncertainty there is about the energy involved in the event, and the other way around. A measurement as accurate as 1,000 trillionth of a second leaves very little uncertainty about the time involved in the emission and absorption of a virtual photon. It does, however, cause a specific uncertainty about how much energy was involved. Because of this uncertainty, the balance books kept by the conservation law of mass energy are not upset. Said another way, the event happens and it is over with so quickly that the electron can get away with it. It is as if the policeman who enforces the conservation law of mass energy turns his back on violations if they happen quickly enough. However, the more flagrant the violation, the more quickly it must happen. If we provide the necessary energy for a virtual photon to become a real photon without violating the conservation law of mass energy, it does just that. That is why an excited electron emits a real photon. An excited electron is an electron that is in an energy level higher than its ground state. An electron's ground state is its lowest energy level, where it is as close to the nucleus of an atom as it can get. The only photons that electrons emit when they are in their ground state are virtual photons, which they immediately reabsorb so as not to violate the conservation law of mass energy. An electron considers the ground state to be its home. It doesn't like to leave home. In fact, the only time it leaves its ground state is when it literally is pushed out of it with extra energy. In that case, the electron's first concern is to get back to its ground state, provided that it hasn't been pushed so far from the nucleus that, in effect, it becomes a free electron. Since the ground state is a low-energy state, the electron must lose its excess energy before it can return to it. Therefore, when an electron is at an energy level higher than its ground state, it jettisons its excess energy in the form of a photon. The jettisoned photon is one of the electron's virtual photons that suddenly finds itself with enough energy to keep going without violating the conservation law of mass energy, and it does. In other words, one of the electron's virtual photons suddenly is promoted to a real photon. The amount of energy, the frequency of the promoted photon, depends upon how much excess energy the electron had to jettison. The discovery that electrons emit only photons of certain energies and no others is what made the quantum theory a quantum theory. Electrons are always surrounded by a swarm of virtual photons. If two electrons come close enough to each other, close enough so that their virtual photon clouds overlap, it is possible that a virtual photon that is emitted from one electron will be absorbed by the other electron. The closer the electrons come to each other, the more this phenomenon occurs. Of course, the process is two-way, with both electrons absorbing virtual photons that were emitted by the other. This is how electrons repel each other. The closer two electrons come, the more virtual photons they exchange. The more virtual photons they exchange, the more sharply their paths are deflected. The repulsive force between them is simply the cumulative effect of these exchanges of virtual photons, the number of which increases at close range and decreases at a distance. According to this theory, there is no such thing as action at a distance, only more and fewer exchanges of virtual photons. These interactions, absorptions and emissions, happen on location, so to speak, right there where the particles involved are located. The mutual repulsion of two particles of the same charge, like two electrons, is an example of an electromagnetic force. In fact, according to quantum field theory, an electromagnetic force is the mutual exchange of virtual photons. Physicists like to say that the electromagnetic force is mediated by photons. Every electrically charged particle continually emits and reabsorbs virtual photons and/or exchanges them with other charged particles. When two electrons, two negative charges, exchange virtual photons, they repulse each other. The same thing happens when two protons, two positive charges, exchange virtual photons. When a proton and an electron, a positive charge and a negative charge, exchange virtual photons, they attract each other. Therefore, since the development of quantum field theory, physicists generally have substituted the word interaction for the word force. An interaction is when anything influences anything else. In this context, a mutual exchange of virtual photons, it is a more precise term than force, which labels that which happens between electrons but does not say anything about it. That part of quantum field theory, Dirac's original part, which deals with electrons, photons, and positrons, is called quantum electrodynamics. Virtual photons, even if they were charged particles, would not be visible in a bubble chamber because of their extremely short lives. Their existence is inferred mathematically. Therefore, this extraordinary theory, that particles exert a force on each other by exchanging other particles, clearly is a free creation of the human mind. It is not necessarily how nature really is. It is only a mental construction which correctly predicts what nature probably is going to do next. There might be, and probably are, other mental constructs that can do as good a job as this one, or better, although physicists have not been able to think of them. The most that we can say about this or any other theory is not whether it is true or not, but only whether it works or not. That is, whether it does what it is supposed to do. Quantum theory is supposed to predict the probabilities of given subatomic phenomena to occur under certain circumstances. Even though quantum field theory as a whole is not totally consistent, the pragmatic reality is that it works. There is a Feynman diagram for every interaction, and every Feynman diagram corresponds to a mathematical formula which precisely predicts the probability of the diagrammed interaction to happen. In 1935, Hideki Yukawa, a graduate student in physics, decided to apply the new virtual particle theory to the strong force. The strong force is the force that keeps atomic nuclei together. It has to be strong because the protons, which along with the neutrons make up the nucleus of an atom, naturally repel each other. Being particles of like sign, positive, protons want to be as far away from each other as they can get. This is because of the electromagnetic force between them. However, within the nucleus of an atom, these mutually repulsive protons not only are kept in close proximity, but they also are bound together very tightly. Whatever is binding these protons together into a nucleus, physicists reasoned, must be a very strong force compared to the electromagnetic force, which works against it. Therefore, they decided to call the strong force, naturally, the strong force. The strong force is well named because it is 100 times stronger than the electromagnetic force. It is the strongest force known in nature. Like the electromagnetic force, it is a fundamental glue. The electromagnetic force holds atoms together externally, with each other to form molecules, and internally, it binds electrons to their orbits around atomic nuclei. The strong force holds the nucleus itself together. The strong force is somewhat muscle-bound, so to speak. Although it is the strongest force known in nature, it also has the shortest range of all the forces known in nature. For example, as a proton approaches the nucleus of an atom, it begins to experience the repulsive electromagnetic force between itself and the protons within the nucleus. The closer the free proton gets to the protons in the nucleus, the stronger the repulsive electromagnetic force between them becomes. At one-third the original distance, for example, the force is 9 times as strong. This force causes a deflection in the path of the free proton. The deflection is a gentle one if the proton is distant from the nucleus, and very pronounced if the proton should come close to the nucleus. However, if we push the free proton to within about 1/10 trillionth, 10 to the minus 13th power, of a centimeter of the nucleus, it suddenly is sucked into the nucleus with a force 100 times more powerful than the repulsive electromagnetic force. 1/10 trillionth of a centimeter is about the size of the proton itself. In other words, the proton is relatively unaffected by the strong force, even at a distance only slightly greater than its own magnitude. Closer than that, however, and it is completely overpowered by the strong force. Yukawa decided to explain this powerful but very short-range strong force in terms of virtual particles. The strong force, theorized Yukawa, is mediated by virtual particles like the electromagnetic force is mediated by virtual photons. According to Yukawa's theory, just as the electromagnetic force is the exchange of virtual photons, the strong force is the exchange of another type of virtual particle. Just as electrons never sit idle but constantly emit and reabsorb virtual photons, so nucleons are not inert but constantly emit and reabsorb their own type of virtual particles. A nucleon is a proton or a neutron. Both of these particles are called nucleons, since both of them are found in the nuclei of atoms. They are so similar to each other that a proton, roughly speaking, can be considered as a neutron with a positive charge. Yukawa knew the range of the strong force from the results of published experiments. Assuming that the limited range of the strong force was identical to the limited range of a virtual particle emitted from a nucleon in the nucleus, he calculated how much time such a virtual particle would require, at close to the speed of light, to go that distance and return to the nucleon. This time calculation allowed him to use the uncertainty relation between time and energy to calculate the energy, mass, of his hypothetical particle. 12 years and one case of mistaken identity later, physicists discovered Yukawa's hypothetical particle. They called it a meson. An entire family of mesons, it later was discovered, are the particles which nucleons exchange to constitute the strong force. The particular meson which physicists discovered first, they called a pion. Pion is short for pi meson. Pions come in three varieties, positive, negative, and neutral. In other words, a proton, like an electron, is a beehive of activity. Not only does it continually emit and reabsorb virtual photons, which makes it susceptible to the electromagnetic force, it also emits and reabsorbs virtual pions, which makes it susceptible to the strong force as well. Particles which do not emit virtual mesons, like electrons, for example, are not affected at all by the strong force. When an electron emits a virtual photon which is absorbed by another particle, the electron is said to be interacting with the other particle. However, when an electron emits a virtual photon and then reabsorbs it, the electron is said to be interacting with itself. Self-interaction makes the world of subatomic particles a kaleidoscopic reality whose very constituents are themselves unceasing processes of transformation. Protons, like electrons, can interact with themselves in more ways than one. The simplest proton self-interaction is the emission and reabsorption, within the time permitted by the uncertainty principle, of a virtual pion. This interaction is analogous to an electron emitting and reabsorbing a virtual photon. First there is a proton, then there is a proton and a neutral pion, then there is a proton again. Because all protons are identical, we can assume that the original proton suddenly ceases to exist, and that at the same point in space and time, another proton and a neutral pion just as abruptly come into existence. The new proton and the neutral pion constitute a violation of the conservation law of mass energy, since their mass together is greater than the mass of the original proton. Something, the neutral pion, literally has been created out of nothing and quickly disappears again, making this a virtual process. The lifespan of the new particles is limited to the time calculated via the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. They quickly merge, annihilating each other, and create another proton. One blink of an eye, figuratively speaking, and the whole thing is over. There is another way in which a proton can interact with itself. In addition to emitting and reabsorbing a neutral pion, a proton can emit a positive pion. However, by emitting a positive pion, the proton momentarily transforms itself into a neutron. First there is a proton, then there is a neutron, which by itself has more mass than the original proton, plus a positive pion, then there is a proton again. In other words, one of the dances that a proton does continually changes it into a neutron and back into a proton again. Every nucleon is surrounded by a cloud of virtual pions, which it constantly emits and reabsorbs. If a proton comes close enough to a neutron so that their virtual pion clouds overlap, some of the virtual pions emitted by the proton are absorbed by the neutron. A proton emits a positively charged pion, momentarily transforming itself into a neutron. Before the pion can be reabsorbed, however, it is captured by a nearby neutron. This pion capture causes the neutron to transform itself into a proton. The exchange of the positive pion causes the proton to become a neutron and the neutron to become a proton. The two original nucleons, now bound together by this exchange, have changed roles. This is the basic Yukawa interaction. The strong force, as Yukawa theorized in 1935, is the multiple exchange of virtual pions between nucleons. The number of the exchanges, the strength of the force, increases at close range and decreases at a distance. In a similar manner, neutrons never sit still and just be neutrons. Like protons and electrons, they also constantly interact with themselves by emitting and reabsorbing virtual particles. Like protons, neutrons emit and reabsorb neutral pions. In addition to emitting a neutral pion, a neutron also can emit a negative pion. However, when a neutron emits a negative pion, it momentarily transforms itself into a proton. First there is a neutron, then there is a proton plus a negative pion, then there is a neutron again. If a neutron comes so close to a proton that their virtual pion clouds overlap, some of the pions that are emitted by the neutron are absorbed by the proton. This is another strong force interaction. A neutron emits a negative pion, temporarily transforming itself into a proton. However, before the negative pion can be reabsorbed, it is captured by a nearby proton, which in turn becomes a neutron. The exchange of a negative pion causes a neutron to become a proton and a proton to become a neutron. As before, a pair of nucleons bound together by a virtual pion exchange have changed roles. There are many more strong force interactions. Although pions are the particles most often exchanged in the creation of the strong force, the other mesons, such as kaons, eta particles, etc., are exchanged as well. There is no strong force. There are only a varying number of virtual particle exchanges between nucleons. The universe, according to physicists, is held together by four fundamental types of glue. In addition to the strong force and the electromagnetic force, there is the weak force and the gravitational force. Footnote: recent evidence gives growing credence to the Weinberg-Salam theory that electromagnetic and weak forces are actually different manifestations of the same force, operating at different distances between particles. End of footnote. Gravity is the long-range force which holds together solar systems, galaxies, and universes. However, on the subatomic level, its effect is so negligible that it is ignored altogether. Future theories hopefully will be able to take it into account. The weak force is the least known of the four forces. Its existence was inferred from the times required by certain subatomic interactions. The strong force is so short-range and powerful that strong force interactions happen very, very fast, in about 10 to the minus 23rd power seconds. However, physicists discovered that a certain other type of particle interaction, which they knew involved neither the electromagnetic nor the gravitational forces, required a much longer time, about 10 to the minus 10th power seconds. They therefore deduced from this strange phenomenon that there must exist a fourth type of force. Since this new fourth force was known to be weaker than the electromagnetic force, it was called the weak force. In order of their strength, the four forces are strong, or nuclear force, electromagnetic force, weak force, gravity. Since the strong force and the electromagnetic force can be explained in terms of virtual particles, physicists assume that the same is true of the weak force and gravity. The particle associated with gravity is the graviton, whose properties have been theorized, but whose existence never has been confirmed. The particle associated with the weak force is the W particle, about which much has been theorized, but not much has been discovered. The range of the strong force relative to the electromagnetic force is limited because mesons relative to photons have so much mass. Remember that the policeman who enforces the conservation law of mass energy is willing to turn his back if the violation is quick enough, but the more flagrant the violation, the more quickly it must happen. The momentary creation of a meson out of nothing is a much more flagrant violation of the conservation law of mass energy than the momentary creation of a photon out of nothing. Therefore, the creation and reabsorption of a meson must happen more quickly to stay within the protection, so to speak, of the uncertainty relation between time and energy. Because the lifespan of a virtual meson is limited, its range also is limited. The rule of thumb governing this phenomenon is this: the stronger the force, the more massive is the mediating particle, and the shorter is its range. The range of the strong force is only about 1/10 trillionth of a centimeter. Accordingly, the range of the electromagnetic force is much greater than the range of the strong force. In fact, the range of the electromagnetic force is infinite. This is because photons don't have any rest mass. "Wait a minute," says Jim DeWitt, agreeing with us for a change. "This doesn't make sense. A virtual photon is a photon which is emitted and reabsorbed quickly enough to avoid violating the conservation law of mass energy, right?" "Right," says a particle physicist on his way to the cyclotron. "Then how can a particle or anything else be emitted and reabsorbed within certain time limits, like the time limits imposed by the uncertainty principle, and still have an infinite range? It doesn't make sense." DeWitt has a point. At first glance, it appears that he is correct. On closer examination, however, there is a subtle logic involved which does make sense. If the limitations of the conservation law of mass energy are avoided by a balance of time and energy, or mass, permitted by the uncertainty principle, and a virtual photon has no rest mass, then it has all the time in the world, literally, to go where it pleases. In other words, there is no practical difference between a real photon and a virtual photon. The only difference between them is that the creation of a real photon does not violate the conservation law of mass energy, and the creation of a virtual photon avoids this law momentarily via the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. This is a good example of how unreal and ivory tower-like the non-mathematical explanation of a successful physical theory can sound. The reason for this is that physical theories, in order to describe more accurately the phenomena under consideration, have become more and more divorced from everyday experience, i.e. more abstract. Although these highly abstract theories, such as quantum theory and relativity, are unaccountably accurate to an awesome degree, they truly are free creations of the human mind. Their primary link with ordinary experience is not the abstract content of their formalisms, but the fact that somehow they work. Footnote. Paul Schilt, editor, Albert Einstein, Philosopher, Scientist, Volume 1, New York, Harper & Row, 1949, has some good essays on this theme. End of footnote. The distinction between a transient, virtual, nothing-something-nothing state and a real one, something-something-something, is similar to the Buddhist distinction between reality as it actually is and the way that we usually see it. For example, Feynman himself described the difference between a virtual state and a real state of a photon as a matter of perspective. What looks like a real process from one point of view may appear as a virtual process occurring over a more extended time. For example, if we wish to study a given real process, such as the scattering of light, we can, if we wish, include in principle the source, scatterer, and eventual absorber of the scattered light in our analysis. We may imagine that no photon is present initially, and that the source then emits light. The light is then scattered and eventually absorbed. From this point of view, the process is virtual, that is, we start with no photons and end with none. Thus, we can analyze the process by means of our formulas for real processes by attempting to break the analysis into parts corresponding to emission, scattering, and absorption. According to Buddhist theory, reality is virtual in nature. What appear to be real objects in it, like trees and people, actually are transient illusions, which result from a limited mode of awareness. The illusion is that parts of an overall virtual process are real, permanent things. Enlightenment is the experience that things, including I, are transient virtual states devoid of separate existences, momentary links between illusions of the past and illusions of the future unfolding in the illusion of time. Particle self-interactions become quite intricate when virtual particles emit virtual particles, which emit virtual particles in a diminishing sequence. A virtual particle, a negative pion, transforms itself momentarily into two more virtual particles, a neutron and an antiproton. Dirac's 1928 theory also predicted antiprotons, which were discovered at Berkeley in 1955. Kenneth Ford, in his book The World of Elementary Particles, diagrams the exquisite dance of a single proton performed in the flicker of time permitted by the uncertainty principle. 11 particles make their transient appearance between the time the original proton transforms itself into a neutron and a pion, and the time it becomes a single proton again. A proton never remains a simple proton. It alternates between being a proton and a neutral pion on the one hand, and being a neutron and a positive pion on the other hand. A neutron never remains a simple neutron. It alternates between being a neutron and a neutral pion on the one hand, and being a proton and a negative pion on the other hand. A negative pion never remains a simple negative pion. It alternates between being a neutron and an antiproton on the one hand, etc., etc. In other words, all particles exist potentially with a certain probability as different combinations of other particles. Each combination has a certain probability of happening. Quantum theory deals with probability. The probability of each of these combinations can be calculated with accuracy. According to quantum theory, however, it is ultimately chance that determines which of these combinations actually occur. The quantum view that all particles exist potentially as different combinations of other particles parallels a Buddhist view again. According to the Flower Garland Sutra, each part of physical reality is constructed of all the other parts. A sutra is a written account of the Buddha's teachings. This theme is illustrated in the Flower Garland Sutra by the metaphor of Indra's net. Indra's net is a vast network of gems which overhangs the palace of the god Indra. In the words of an English interpreter, "In the heaven of Indra, there is said to be a network of pearls, so arranged that if you look at one, you see all the others reflected in it. In the same way, each object in the world is not merely itself, but involves every other object, and in fact is everything else." The appearance of physical reality, according to Mahayana Buddhism, is based upon the interdependence of all things. Although this book is not about physics and Buddhism specifically, the similarities between the two, especially in the field of particle physics, are so striking and plentiful that a student of one necessarily must find value in the other. Now we come to the most psychedelic aspect of particle physics. Imagine now a Feynman diagram of a three-particle interaction in which no lines lead to or away from the particle interaction. This diagram might resemble, say, a tilted football, with a bottom curved line, a top curved line, and a line running through the middle. The three lines intersect at both ends of the football, creating events. In this diagram, no world line leads up to the interaction, and no world line leads away from it. It just happens. It happens literally out of nowhere, for no apparent reason and without any apparent cause. Where there was no thing, suddenly, in a flash of spontaneous existence, there are three particles which vanish without a trace. This type of Feynman diagram is called a vacuum diagram. That is because the interactions happen in a vacuum. A vacuum, as we normally construe it, is a space that is entirely empty. Vacuum diagrams, however, graphically demonstrate that there is no such thing. From empty space comes something, and then that something disappears again into empty space. In the subatomic realm, a vacuum obviously is not empty. So where did the notion of a completely empty, barren, and sterile space come from? We made it up. There is no such thing in the real world as empty space. It is a mental construction, an idealization, which we have taken to be true. Empty and full are false distinctions that we have created, like the distinction between something and nothing. They are abstractions from experience which we have mistaken for experience. Perhaps we have lived so long in our abstractions that instead of realizing that they are drawn from the real world, we believe that they are the real world. Vacuum diagrams are the serious product of a well-intentioned physical science. However, they are also wonderful reminders that we can intellectually create our reality. It is not possible, according to our usual conceptions, for something to come out of empty space. But at the subatomic level, it does, which is what vacuum diagrams illustrate. In other words, there is no such thing as empty space, or nothing, except as a concept in our categorizing minds. The core sutras of Mahayana Buddhism, the type of Buddhism practiced in Tibet, China, and Japan, are called the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Among the most central of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, there are 12 volumes of them, is a sutra which is called simply the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra contains one of the most important ideas of Mahayana Buddhism. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Imagine a vacuum diagram of 6 different mutually interacting particles. There are 6 lines in the diagram, forming the crossbars of a kite and the outline of a kite. At each of the 4 corners of the kite are points indicating events where the particles interact. This depicts an exquisite dance of emptiness becoming form and form becoming emptiness. Perhaps, as the wise people of the East have written, form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. In any case, vacuum diagrams are representations of remarkable transformations of something into nothing, and nothing into something. These transformations occur continuously in the subatomic realm and are limited only by the uncertainty principle, the conservation laws, and probability. There are roughly 12 conservation laws. Some of them affect every type of subatomic interaction. Some of them affect only some types of subatomic interaction. There is a simple rule of thumb to remember. The stronger the force, the more its interactions are restrained by conservation laws. For example, strong interactions are restrained by all 12 conservation laws. Electromagnetic interactions are restrained by 11 of the conservation laws. And weak interactions are restrained by only 8 of the conservation laws. Gravitational interactions, those involving the most feeble force in the subatomic world, have not been studied yet. No one has found a graviton, but they may violate even more conservation laws. Nonetheless, where the conservation laws have jurisdiction, they are inviolable rules which shape the form of all particle interactions. For example, the conservation law of mass energy dictates that all spontaneous particle decays be downhill. When a single particle spontaneously decays, it always decays into lighter particles. The total mass of the new particles is always less than the mass of the original particle. The difference between the mass of the original particle and the total mass of the new particles is converted into kinetic energy of the new particles, which fly away. Uphill interactions are only possible when kinetic energy, in addition to the energy of being, mass, of the original particles, is available for the creation of new particles. 2 colliding protons, for example, can create a proton, a neutron, and a positive pion. The total mass of these new particles is greater than the mass of the 2 original protons. This is possible because some of the kinetic energy of the projectile proton went into the creation of the new particles. In addition to mass energy, momentum is conserved in every particle interaction. The total momentum carried by particles going into an interaction must equal the total momentum of the particles leaving the interaction. This is why the spontaneous decay of a single particle always produces at least 2 new particles. A particle at rest has 0 momentum. If it decays into a single new particle which then flies off, the momentum of the new particle will exceed the momentum of the original particle, 0. The momenta of at least 2 new particles flying off in opposite directions, however, cancel each other, producing a total momentum of 0. Charge also is conserved in every particle interaction. If the total charge of the particles entering an interaction is plus 2, for example, 2 protons, the total charge of the particles leaving the interaction must also equal plus 2, after the positive and negative particles cancel each other. Spin, too, is conserved, although keeping the books balanced in regard to spin is more complicated than it is in regard to charge. In addition to the conservation laws of mass energy, momentum, charge, and spin, there are conservation laws of family numbers. For example, if 2 baryons, or heavyweight particles, like 2 protons, go into an interaction, two baryons must be among the resulting new particles, like a neutron and a lambda particle. This same baryon conservation law, along with the conservation law of mass energy, explains why protons are stable particles, i.e. why they do not decay spontaneously. Spontaneous decays must be downhill to satisfy the conservation law of mass energy. Protons cannot decay downhill without violating the conservation law of baryon family numbers, because protons are the lightest baryons. If a proton were to decay spontaneously, it would have to decay into particles lighter than itself, but there are no baryons lighter than a proton. In other words, if a proton were to decay, there would be one less baryon in the world. In fact, this never happens. This scheme, the conservation law of baryon family numbers, is the only way that physicists so far have been able to account for the proton's stability. A similar conservation law of lepton family numbers accounts for the stability of electrons. There are no lighter leptons than an electron. Some of the 12 conservation laws are actually invariance principles. An invariance principle is a law that says, under a change of circumstances, like changing the location of an experiment, all of the laws of physics remain valid. All of the laws of physics, so to speak, is the conserved quantity of an invariance principle. For example, there is a time reversal invariance principle. In order for a process to be possible, according to this principle, it must be reversible in time. If a positron electron annihilation can create two photons, it can, then the annihilation of two photons can create a positron and an electron, it can. Conservation laws and invariance principles are based on what physicists call symmetries. Conservation laws and invariance principles are based on what physicists call symmetries. The fact that space is the same in all directions, isotropic, and in all places, homogeneous, is an example of symmetry. The fact that time is homogeneous is another example. These symmetries simply mean that a physics experiment performed in Boston this spring will give the same result as the same experiment performed in Moscow next fall. In other words, physicists now believe that the most fundamental laws of physics, the conservation laws and invariance principles, are based upon those foundations of our reality that are so basic that they go unnoticed. This does not mean, probably, that it has taken physicists 300 years to realize that moving an object, like a telephone, around the country does not distort its shape or size, space is homogeneous, nor does turning it upside down, space is isotropic, nor does letting it get 2 weeks older, time is homogeneous. Everyone knows that this is the way our physical world is constructed. Where and when a subatomic experiment is performed are not critical data. The laws of physics do not change with time and place. It does mean, however, that it has taken physicists 300 years to realize that the most simple and beautiful mathematical structures may be those that are based on these unobtrusively obvious conditions. Theoretical physics, roughly speaking, has branched into two schools. One school follows the old way of thinking, and the other school follows new ways of thinking. Physicists who follow the old way of thinking continue their search for the elementary building blocks of the universe in spite of the Hall of Mirrors predicament. For these physicists, the most likely candidate at present for the title of ultimate building block of the universe is the quark. A quark is a type of hypothetical particle theorized by Murray Gell-Mann in 1964. It is named after a word in James Joyce's book, Finnegan's Wake. All known particles, the theory goes, are composed of various combinations of a few, 12, different types of quarks. No one has found a quark yet, but many are looking. It is an extraordinarily elusive particle, as many now known particles were in the past, with some strange characteristics. For example, quarks are theorized to have one-third unit of electrical charge. Never before has charge been found in other than whole units. The great quark hunt could become very exciting in the near future, but no matter what is discovered in the future, one thing about it already is certain. The discovery of quarks will open an entirely new area of research, namely, what are quarks made of? The physicists who follow the new ways of thinking are pursuing so many different approaches to understanding subatomic phenomena that it is not possible to present them all. Some of these physicists feel that space and time are all that there is. According to this theory, actors, action, and stage are all manifestations of an underlying four-dimensional geometry. Others, like David Finkelstein, are exploring processes which lie beneath time, processes from which space and time, the very fabric of experiential reality, are derived. These theories at the moment are speculative. They cannot be proven, demonstrated mathematically. The most successful departure from the unending search for the ultimate particle syndrome is the S-matrix theory. In S-matrix theory, the dance, rather than the dancers, is of primary importance. S-matrix theory is different because it places the emphasis upon interactions rather than upon particles. S-matrix is short for scattering matrix. Scattering is what happens to particles when they collide. A matrix is a type of mathematical table. An S-matrix is a table of probabilities. When subatomic particles collide, several things usually are possible. For example, the collision of two protons can create 1. A proton, a neutron, and a positive pion. 2. A proton, a lambda particle, and a positive kaon. 3. Two protons and 6 assorted pions. 4. Numerous other combinations of subatomic particles. Each of these possible combinations, which are the combinations that do not violate the conservation laws, occurs with a certain probability. In other words, some of them occur more often than others. The probabilities of various combinations in turn depend upon such things as how much momentum is carried into the collision area. In an S-matrix, all of these probabilities are tabulated in such a way that we can look up or calculate the possible results of any collision along with their probabilities if we know what particles initially collide and how much momentum they have. Of course, there are so many possible combinations of particles, each one of which can yield a variety of results, that a complete matrix, or table, containing all the probabilities of all the possible combinations of particles would be enormous. In fact, such a complete table has not been compiled. This is no immediate problem, however, since physicists are concerned only with a small part of the S matrix at any one time. For example, the part which deals with two proton collisions. Such parts of the total S-matrix are called elements of the S-matrix. The major limitation of S-matrix theory is that at present it applies only to the strongly interacting particles, mesons and baryons, which as a group are called hadrons. Let's make an S-matrix diagram of a subatomic interaction. It's very simple. The collision area is a circle. Particles 1 and 2 go into the collision area from below, and particles 3 and 4 come out of the collision area above. The diagram tells nothing about what happened at the point of collision. It shows only what particles went into the interaction and what particles came out of the interaction. An S-matrix diagram is not a space-time diagram. It does not show the position of the particles in space or time. This is intentional because we do not know the exact positions of the interacting particles. We have chosen to measure their momenta, and consequently their position is unknown, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. For this reason, S-matrix diagrams indicate only that an interaction took place in a certain area inside the circle. They are purely symbolic representations of particle interactions. Not all interactions involve only two initial particles and two final particles. For instance, three particles might enter the circle and two particles might leave. Or three particles might enter the circle and three particles might leave. Or two particles might enter the circle and three particles might leave. Like Feynman diagrams, S-matrix diagrams can be rotated. For instance, when an S-matrix diagram of a proton colliding with a negative pion to produce a proton and a negative pion is rotated, it becomes a diagram of a proton-antiproton annihilation producing a negative pion and a positive pion. The positive pion is the antiparticle of the negative pion in the original reaction. Every time a diagram is rotated, it depicts another possible interaction. This particular S-matrix diagram can be rotated 4 times. All of the particles that can be depicted by rotating a single element of the S-matrix are intimately related to each other. In fact, all of the particles represented in an S-matrix diagram, including those discovered by rotating the diagram, are defined in terms of each other. Which of them are elementary is a meaningless question. Since the particles resulting from an interaction often become involved in other interactions, separate elements of the S-matrix can be assembled diagrammatically into a network of related interactions. Each network, as well as each interaction, is associated with a certain probability. These probabilities can be calculated. According to S-matrix theory, particles are intermediate states in a network of interactions. The lines in an S-matrix diagram are not the world lines of different particles. Lines in an S-matrix diagram of an interaction network are reaction channels through which energy flows. A neutron, quote-unquote, for example, is a reaction channel. It can be formed by a proton and a negative pion. If more energy is available, however, the same channel can be created by a lambda particle and a neutral kaon and several other particle combinations as well. In short, S-matrix theory is based upon events, not upon things. Dancers no longer stand apart as significant entities. In fact, the dancers are not even defined except in terms of each other. In S-matrix theory, there is only the dance. We've come a long way from Newton and his proverbial apple. Nonetheless, apples are a real part of the apparent world. When we eat an apple, we are aware of who is eating and what is being eaten as distinct from the action of eating. The idea that objects exist apart from events is part of the epistemological net with which we snare our particular form of experience. This idea is dear to us because we have accepted it without question as the basis of our reality. It profoundly influences how we see ourselves. It is the root of our inescapable sense of separateness from others and environment. The history of scientific thought, if it teaches us anything at all, teaches us the folly of clutching ideas too closely. To this extent, it is an echo of Eastern wisdom which teaches us the folly of clutching anything.